Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I'd like to thank you all for coming out on a rainy night. So you're all brave souls to make it here, so congratulations. I'm a professor here and director of the UCSF Depression Center, and also the principal investigator of several studies we're going to be talking a bit about, but particularly the Practicing Alternatives to Heal Depression study. We call it, for short, the PATH-D study. And those are that and another study also involving depression and meditation and neuroimaging are both actively recruiting. And as you learn more about it, if you're interested, we have some information packets, and if you have questions, feel free to call the numbers there. And we have one of our research assistants, Natalie, who's here. So you may pigeonhole her at the end as well. So thanks again for coming. I'm going to be discussing mindfulness in general terms and also how we apply it for in specific relationship to treating depression. And there's been a resurgence of interest in using mindfulness meditation as an approach to help people with depression over the past 5 to 10 years. And I think it's leading to some very interesting applications and potentially very helpful for a great number of people. How many of you have a mindfulness practice of your own? Maybe if you could just show. Okay, so a fair number. Mindfulness, basically, there's different definitions of it. Probably the most commonly used one is the one by Jon Kabat-Zinn, meaning paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. So mindfulness means focusing the attention in this present moment and letting go of the future, letting go of the past, and just coming to be aware of whatever is present right now. This is another definition of it. It's non-evaluative awareness of one's inner and outer environment. Non-evaluative, just like non-judgmental, is, oh, I notice I have pain from my arm resting against the side of the chair or something like that. It's noticing it and not saying this is good or bad, but just being aware and observing it. So mindfulness is bringing that non-judgmental attention to bear on something with intention. Mindfulness has been used for a wide variety of different conditions. Jon Kabat-Zinn really brought it into public consciousness with his stress reduction efforts, mindfulness-based stress reduction, at the University of Massachusetts about 25 to 30 years ago. But it's been applied for other conditions, pain, psoriasis, eating disorders, fibromyalgia pain, cancer. The Osher Center here is using it for parenting, teaching people how to be more mindful in their parenting, or even as an alternative to coping with labor pains. And then on the psychiatric side of things, it's been used for treating anxiety, depression, people with borderline personality disorder who have difficulty regulating emotions, for addictions, and even for bipolar disorder. Some of these are more experimental. They haven't been widely developed, but they're all moving forward. And the most developed area is the one I'm going to focus on tonight, and I'm going to give you some examples of it, and that is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, because that's the main intervention of our practicing alternatives to heal. Sorry about that. I guess I'm free of viruses, hopefully. The mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is our primary intervention for teaching people mindfulness approaches to depression over an 8-week course. Just to say a little bit about depression. You know, people used to sort of try to decide what kind of depression a person had. Is it this? Is it this? Or maybe that? Or somewhere on the depression highway. What we know now is it doesn't really matter so much how the person got there. If they have depressive symptoms, which are these, if they have these, they deserve to be treated. So it's inappropriate to say, well, of course this person is depressed because they got just received a cancer diagnosis, or because they had a breakup, or this or that. If somebody has these symptoms lasting for 2 weeks or longer, that's significant evidence of depression, and they deserve to be treated. Otherwise, it'd be like saying somebody comes into the emergency room after having a major artery severed by in a knife fight and saying, well, of course they're in shock, but we're not going to treat them. If they have depressive symptoms, they need to be treated. And these are the hallmarks of what we call DSM-4. If you have five or more of these symptoms for 2 weeks or longer, essentially you're talking about somebody having clinical depression, or what we call major depression, which is the same terminology. So what do we do with our program? Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is a mixture of some cognitive therapy aspects, and many of you are probably familiar with, in one way or another, with cognitive behavior therapy or cognitive therapy, and it mixes some elements from that with a very strong dose of mindfulness meditation. And it's primarily mindfulness meditation that is the heart of the program. And it's 8 weekly sessions, and they're 2 to 2.25 hours in length. And people, on the other hand, on the other 6 days of the week, when they're not coming in for the class, do a daily meditation practice at home. They're run in groups of 6 to 14 people, and it consists of different types of mindfulness exercises, things like formal practice, of like a sitting meditation, paying attention to the breath, a body scan, paying attention to different sensations in the body, mindful stretching or hatha yoga, and then a variety of other mindfulness approaches where you attend to different things. And then there are informal practices where people become more familiar with, say, eating mindfully or doing everyday activities, but in a more mindful way. And we also teach very portable techniques, such as a 3-minute breathing space. So at the end of this, the person has gotten familiar with a variety of techniques, and not everybody is going to be the same in what they walk away with. Some people may like the body scan, and some people may hate it. Some people may like this element or this element, and that's perfectly fine. We know that it varies from person to person. We're trying to expose them to a potpourri of different options so that by the time they finish, they have a practice that they can walk away with and start applying for the rest of their life. This is not a technique where you take the course and you're done with it. What we're doing is offer the course, and at the end of 8 weeks, the person is prepared to go on with their life, incorporating a practice in their everyday life. Here I am on the beach doing a formal breath practice, but here's another one. This is a young fellow showing the portability of using mindfulness in a variety of settings. So let's to give you a little better flavor for this, I thought we would do an exercise so we all at least have a little common ground here for mindfulness. So if you're game for this, if you'll sit in your seat and get in a comfortable position with your both feet planted on the floor, and if you feel like it, you can close your eyes. If you rather, you can just gaze softly at the seat in front of you. And what I'd like you to do is just focus in on the breath moving in and out through your nostrils. Just paying attention to the breath, focusing the attention on the breath moving in and out. If the mind wanders as you're doing this, gently and kindly bring the attention back to the breath. Now, as you continue to focus on the breath, I'd like you to add a second element to this, and that is begin counting each inspiration. And start counting it from zero and count up to 10 breaths. If your mind wanders, as minds tend to do, on the way up to 10, just go back down to zero and start counting again. If you get up to 10, go back down to zero and start doing it again. And whenever you're ready, you can open your eyes and bring the attention back to the room. Okay, would anybody like to say what that experience was like for you, what you observed?
I found that my breathing slowed the longer I did.
Your breathing slowed?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Relaxing, falling asleep.
Got a heightened awareness of other stuff, like squats.
Heightened awareness. So then did you go back to zero and start up again?
Yeah.
Excellent. Very good. Was anybody, did anybody notice their mind wandering? Was that surprising? Have you noticed how your mind tends to wander? Sometimes until you get into a state of stillness, you don't really pay attention to it. And that's one of the things that we're interested in our work in applying mindfulness, is that people often walk around on automatic pilot without paying attention to it because they're so preoccupied by things that are popping into their mind. Sylvia Boorstein talks about our minds as being popcorn poppers of thoughts. They just pop up. And if somebody has trouble with anxiety or depression, a lot of those thoughts that pop up are depressogenic or anxiogenic, that they produce depression so that the thoughts may be of a pending catastrophe or of a past catastrophe, because anxiety tends to be, in many ways, future-oriented. And depression, future-oriented in the sense of there's some disaster that's going to happen, whereas depression tends to be past-oriented because the person feels as if some disaster has already happened to them. So with mindfulness, you're helping the person focus on the present moment and give a release from future or past focusing and just focus on the present moment. But I think as you could see from this exercise, it's very common for these thoughts to be popping into our mind unbidden. It's completely normal, and no matter whether you're the most advanced meditator or not, this is what happens. Many people are under the mistaken conception that meditation means you focus the attention and you lock your attention onto something and then it doesn't change. But actually, that's incorrect. What happens with meditation is you focus your attention and then your mind wanders. And the meditation is noticing, my mind just wandered. I wonder what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. Or I had this interaction with this person before that irritated me. Or what do I have to do tomorrow? Or whatever the case may be. And our minds do it all the time. Or I feel this sensation that's bothering me. Or I feel an itch. So as those thoughts occur in depression, what happens is these are often biased towards the negative. So the person has thoughts like, this is going to be a disaster, or in this instance, maybe everybody in the audience is going to fall asleep on me, or something like that. What we're helping people to get the skill of becoming focused on that present moment and being able to let go of a thought and bring the attention back. And that's the heart of what we're talking about with mindfulness. Now, I'm going to say a bit about these studies. The PATH D study is we're taking people who have treatment-resistant depression. And by that, I mean people who have failed to recover fully with two or more antidepressant trials. And unfortunately, this is not uncommon. If somebody has major depression and you treat them with an antidepressant at full doses, only one-third of them will fully recover with that initial treatment. You have to give a second antidepressant trial to get 50% of them recovered fully. So that means after two antidepressant trials, only 50% are recovered. And our concern was trying to help get these other people fully recovered. So we are studying individuals who have had two or more antidepressant trials and want to try this approach to getting fully recovered. And we're taking them, splitting them into two groups. One gets mindfulness-based cognitive therapy plus their medication management or a health enhancement program, which consists of physical activity, physical exercise, music therapy, and nutritional education by a dietitian. So they both get 8 weeks of classes, but they're completely different. One is mindfulness meditation focused, and the other is health enhancement focused. And we're going to see if there's a difference in outcomes and what that difference looks like in seeing how if people can recover more effectively using one of these approaches. These are people, this is from our current research. We've actually enrolled about 100 people so far, but if you take a look at this, the episode length of people is 91 months, and they've suffered with depression for almost 30 years. And this is essentially a similar division. In both of these, this is one is getting, they're blinded, so we don't know. One is getting MBCT and one is getting the health enhancement. That's why it's a condition B or A, because they're blinded till the end of the trial. But they're both, as you see, when people suffer from depression, it tends to be a recurrent disease. So it's very important to try to get them to fully recover. That gives them the best chance of not having depression again in the future. We're adding to this, and I'm going to show you towards in the second half of today's talk some of the interesting, I think, and quite exciting findings about the actual brain changes that take place with depression and with mindfulness meditation to some extent. Because we've added a second component to the study where we're getting fMRI before and after mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and after health enhancement. So we're looking at their brain function before and after. And fMRI is similar to an MRI, but if you take an MRI of a person, if you take an MRI and just look at it, if I had one up here, you couldn't tell whether it was on a living or dead individual. It's a structural image, basically. The fMRI stands for functional. That actually shows how the brain is functioning second to second. So it shows which areas of the brain are lighting up or not lighting up in response to stimuli. So it's a much more dynamic picture of how the brain is actually functioning. We're doing a second study for individuals who are not on any medication or in any psychotherapy. This is the Depression, Meditation, and Neuroimaging Study. And it's MBCT, the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, as a standalone treatment. And we're, again, looking at people before and after with fMRI and comparing them to how much these people, and I'll show you some of the images from this area, how much these people return to look like healthy controls. So how much their brain abnormalities that are present before treatment change with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Let's talk a little bit of how does mindfulness actually work in helping people with depression. And I think I've alluded to some of the things already here. One is the focus on the here and now. In some ways, depression and anxiety can be considered, I think, as time-based diseases, where the person is focused so much on the future and disasters or focused on the past that they're not in the present moment. I mean, it's kind of like, I think we've all had the experience where you go to a lecture, perhaps, or a concert, or whatever the case may be, and then you forget about, well, did I, you know, do something I should have done? Did I mail that letter, or did I do, you know, lock that door or something? Something that sort of stays on our mind, keeping us out of the present moment and being able to enjoy the present activity that we're attending to. So mindfulness helps teach individuals to be able to let go of those orientations and come to awareness about what's happening right in this moment. In fact, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was originally called selective attention training because it trains people to focus very precisely. And this has important ramifications both psychologically and also in terms of some of the brain effects that we'll take a look at in a little bit. Mindfulness also helps people to stop ruminating. Ruminating is a condition where one continues to think about a situation and goes over and over in their mind. You can actually ruminate about ruminating. I mean, when I started reading about ruminating, I mean, you know, you could really go nuts. I mean, there's, you know, there's ruminating, there's pondering, there's brooding, you know, there's all kinds of things that you can get into. Brooding is the bad one. But it turns out teaching people mindfulness skills in 8 weeks decreases rumination. Rumination is a driver of depression. So many people with depression ruminate. For example, a young woman who had a breakup in a relationship keeps on ruminating about, well, what did I do wrong? What should I have said? What did, you know, why did this happen? Why did he leave me? And it keeps on going over and over again. That's not problem solving. Problem solving leads to a solution. Ruminating leads to worse depression. And that's one way of testing what it is you're doing. If you ask somebody who's ruminating, what do you think you're doing? What is happening when you're ruminating? Well, they think I'm trying to prevent it from happening again, or I'm trying to figure out what went wrong. Well, how do you feel afterwards? You could just do a brief study, ruminate for a short period of time and see how you feel. Usually they feel worse. And so you're helping the person to disengage from rumination by saying, okay, what we do in mindfulness is something like this. Okay, focus on the breath and then notice, I just had this thought about that breakup. I just had that thought. But I can let that thought go and bring the attention back. So it's really radically different than other kinds of psychotherapy, which get into trying to explore and look at things in a more traditional psychotherapeutic way. This doesn't do that. This is focused more on attention. And as you'll see, I'm going to show you the differences. What mindfulness teaches is basically increased decentering, we call it, where the person starts to get some distance from thoughts and feelings. So when they have something going on, like I have the thought something bad is going to happen, And typically, the person with a depressive kind of state or an anxious state tends to believe that thought. They say, oh, this disaster is actually going to happen. Now, if any of us believe that a disaster is going to happen, why wouldn't you get anxious or depressed about it? But the trick is, that thought is not a fact. It's just one of those popcorn thoughts that occurred in your mind. And in depression, for example, you tend to latch onto it and believe it as if it's true. And in mindfulness, you learn to be able to say, ah, there's a thought, but I can let it go. I don't have to hang on to it and believe it. And it also helps, mindfulness also helps in helping the individual become more compassionate, both to the others, but very importantly, to themselves. So they become gentler with themselves. How does this happen? Well, some of it is that you got a little glimpse of it, you know, when we went through that exercise, and I said if or when you notice your mind wandering, you just notice that, and you don't say, gosh darn it, what the heck is wrong with you? You know, you don't come down on yourself. You say, ah, my mind wandered, and I bring the attention back. So you're kinder and gentler and can forgive yourself for things through this technique. So it's basically teaching people how to see thoughts and feelings as mental events and not as facts. Here's another example of this. Let's do this as a group. So if you're, picture this, you're walking down the street and it's a nice day, not a rainy one, and you see somebody you know on the other side of the street and you wave to them and they don't wave back, they just keep on walking. What do you think or feel in that situation? Anybody? Hurt.
Foolish.
They're busy.
They didn't have any glasses on.
They didn't have their glasses on.
They didn't see
me. Okay.
What's their problem?
What's their problem? So, any other feelings? Those are some good thoughts.
But they suck because they didn't say hi.
They suck. Okay, good. What was that?
Shunned?
Yeah, okay. So there's a variety of things. We do this actually in the group. And you see, I mean, we just had 10 people give different ideas or feelings about the situation. Nobody actually knows what the fact was, right? I didn't say whether this guy or this other person saw you or didn't see you or didn't have glasses or not. We all come up with our own ideas about it. We don't actually know. But if you attach to a certain thing and say, well, I know this person rejected me, then it generates certain feelings. But when we did this in one group, for example, a fellow said, yeah, that happened to me, and I never spoke to that person again. You know, because I know he was shunning me, you know, and so on. By the end of 8 weeks, he was saying, boy, that was ridiculous. I didn't know anything about what was going on, and it could have been any of these other possibilities. So instead of hanging on to this thought like, oh, this is a fact, it's just a thought. It's one of these popcorn thoughts that occur in our mind. And one thing I've seen repeatedly, and this might be, I don't know what your take is on this, but our minds are not always our best friends. You know, does that seem odd to you? You know, in many ways, our minds are like bad friends. You know, you don't want to go there without a friend at your side. But our minds, especially if you're prone towards depression or anxiety, tends to have these popcorn thoughts coming up that are very negative. So they come up and say, yeah, look, you know, this just happened. You know, this bad thing just happened, and it's because of your weakness or failure or whatever it is. And these thoughts that come up from our mind are really as if it's a bad friend, not even necessarily a friend. Somebody, I was doing this. This was driven home to me when I was actually meditating one time, and my mind got distracted, and I was thinking about this interaction at work with somebody, and I was kind of getting agitated about it and trying to bring my mind back, and this was going on. And then I realized these thoughts I were having, it sounded like somebody I knew and didn't like. And I said, what am I listening to this for? You know, it's like if somebody you didn't like says you're ugly, or something else, you take it much differently than if a friend of yours did that. We often don't think of our mind as not being our friend, but in many instances, our mind isn't our friend. And that, I think, deserves to be paid attention to in these states of anxiety and depression. And this is sometimes, we use the term decentering, or what is called metacognition, because it's beyond cognitive therapy. In a sense, we're not paying attention to the content of thoughts, we're paying attention to the thought processes. And that's really how this differs from other therapies. And if you can recognize this, it's very liberating, because you realize that these thoughts are really not facts. They're just something that's coming up, and if you can let them go, it's so much freer for you. It allows you to be in a position to respond skillfully and not just react. As a friend of mine, Paul Ekman, described it, mindfulness tends to give you more of a gap between the spark and the flame. So you have an opportunity, instead of saying, oh, I'm angry at this guy for not waving back and this or that, or I'm depressed about this, saying, well, wait, what are some other possibilities that might have gone on, like the 10 we just heard, that there's a whole variety of things. So this is how mindfulness-based cognitive therapy differs from traditional CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. In cognitive behavior therapy, the person might say something, and incidentally, like in depression, the main negative cognitions have all been cataloged. We give people in our class a list of the top 30. It's like Letterman's top 30, and then ask people to check off which ones apply to them, because it's different for each person. But they're all really known. Like, I'm a rotten person, I feel like a failure, I am a failure, I'll never be successful, blah, 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 blah. And so the person says, I'm a bad person. Well, in mindfulness-based, let's go with this for a moment. They say, I'm a bad person. So in cognitive therapy, what happens is you attend to that, and you try to help the person look at it a little bit differently. You may have them challenge that. You say, well, I'm a bad person. Well, what's the evidence for that, Stu, that you're a bad person? I stepped on an ant before I came in here. I pushed clothes on the elevator when somebody was running up. Is there any evidence you're a good person? Well, I did help this person cross the street or this or that. So a more balanced thought would be, I'm bad in many ways, elevator-wise, but in some ways, I'm an okay person. So you're helping the person answer back and change the thought content. That's what cognitive behavior therapy does. In mindfulness, when the person says, I'm a bad person, what you do is this. Say, you're having the thought you're a bad person. Now, we've decentered. I'm having the thought I'm a bad person. Now, what do you want to do with that? We're not saying let's change that. Because one of the challenges in doing cognitive therapy, and I did cognitive therapy for a long time and I ran cognitive therapy groups, you get somebody who's been depressed for a long time, and remember those figures from earlier, people with depression can be depressed for a long time. If you say, what's the evidence that you're not a bad person, or that you're a bad person, they say, you want evidence? I got a bushel basket full of evidence for you. because they've been depressed for so many years that they've been raking in all this negative evidence. So this doesn't get into that. Sometimes in those groups, I would feel like I was an attorney, you know, like I was trying to prove a case or something with them, and I was, you know, saying that they're not such a bad person or something because they were rigorously hanging on to it. In this, you don't do that. You say, okay, I'm having the thought I'm a bad person, and what do you want to do with that thought? And you're focusing on the thought process and say, well, if you like, you can let that go. I'm not going to challenge the thought and try to prove it one way or another. This is a different approach. This is, okay, you have the thought, but you now are in a position to say, let that go, just like you let go of other thoughts and brought your attention back to something. It also identifies those thoughts as not a fact. Like I'm having the thought I'm a bad person. That's not a fact. That's just a thought, and allows the person to have a different way of being in the world. Whereas this CBT is more focused on looking at those negative things and trying to challenge those beliefs and come up with new ways and new thought content, which is good for many people, but sometimes it's quite challenging for people in doing cognitive therapy. And this is a different approach. So what do we do with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy? It was originally developed as a relapse prevention program to help people stay free of depression once they had fully recovered from an episode. So the first study that was done in the year 2000 looked at people. Half the people got mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and half of them got treatment as usual. And it showed that it basically many more people stayed free of depression if they had had the mindfulness training, about twice as many. So that was a very good sign. Particularly, it was for people who had three or more episodes of depression. For people who had just one or two episodes, there wasn't much difference. But these are for people who had chronic recurrent depression. Another repeat of that study showed even somewhat better results in that more people stayed free of depression. Those were by the originators of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. This was a study done, and that was that earlier study was in Canada and England. This study was done in Belgium in 2010 and actually basically showed the same thing. It was by people other than the originators, so can other people get the same kind of results? And this showed, again, the people with mindfulness training tended to stay in remission compared to people who relapsed down here. This is a survival curve. So many more people stayed free of depression. Now, those were people getting treatment as usual. So in some ways, they were good preliminary studies, but they weren't so powerful because some people were getting mindfulness training and the 8 weeks of group, and the others weren't getting anything. So you could say, well, it's not that surprising that they had the experimental group did so well. This was a more demanding study. This was done at Exeter University in England, and it took people at high risk for depression. They had multiple episodes of depression. And as many of you may know, sort of the gold standard is for people like that is to maintain them on antidepressant medication. If somebody's had three or more depression episodes, you would say, well, this person probably should be maintained on medicine rather than put on medicine and then taken off and put on, taken off. They probably should be stabilized on medication is the conventional wisdom. And sort of like if somebody has high blood pressure, you don't take them on and off. If they have it recurrently, you would probably treat them on an ongoing basis. So it took these people who had recovered from depression and then randomized them into two groups. One got mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and were tapered off of their antidepressant, and the other group got maintained on an antidepressant. So it was a much more active comparison for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy really essentially the gold standard treatment.
Of, they were being tapered off their medication?
Yes. Yeah. They were tapered off in the first 3 months. It was a year-long study, and they were tapered off in the first 3 months. So if they were going to relapse, there would be an opportunity for them to relapse during the study. Well, I mean, because if they tapered them off at the end of the study, you know, it wouldn't have, would have been meaningless. So they tried to get them off of it, and there was a certain schedule that they used to do so. And then they followed them up for 1 year. How many people think MBCT was better? Okay. How many people think maintenance antidepressants were better? Not many. Huh? Well, you're both wrong. They were equivalent. They were equivalent. So they were the same. If you take people off the antidepressant and taper them off, essentially, or if you kept them on maintenance, they both showed the same rates of relapse. The people who were, however, there was a significant difference, and the people who had mindfulness training had less residual depression and improved quality of life. So it was an interesting study. The pharmaceutical makers didn't sponsor this one. This is another study. It's an interesting one. It was a very unique, powerful study which showed basically that people who were randomized to three groups after they achieved remission. Either they maintained antidepressants, or they got MBCT training, or they were given a placebo. So it was a very unique and really exacting study. And basically what it showed, for people who were unstable remitters, that means people who had ups and downs, that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy or antidepressant maintenance were much more effective than placebo. In preventing relapse. But here's an interesting feature. For people who were stable remitters, that means people who got better with their initial treatment and didn't vary. When they say stable remitters, what they mean is this. We use a scale called the Hamilton most commonly in these studies. So if below this level is remission. You want to have as few symptoms as possible. So people who remitted and were 7 or lower, that which is in remission, and stayed there for the length of the treatment that they were receiving, those people were called stable versus the unstable remitters were people who were kind of bouncing up and down into remission. The people who are stable remitters, actually all three of the conditions had this equivalent effect in preventing relapse, which was an interesting finding, and again, goes against that conventional wisdom of saying that people had to be maintained on medication. Although this is the first study that had showed this effect, and it was a very unique finding. Let me say a little bit about treatment-resistant depression. That, as we've said, are the people who don't remit with two or more antidepressant trials. And basically, if you take people and follow them out over the course of the year, you really end up with a very limited amount of people who have remitted, 43% in this one study, at the end of a year of treatment. So it's a very challenging condition to treat. And it's important for people to know this, because that's why mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was initially developed, is we need to find better ways of preventing relapse. It tends to be a relapsing illness, and you have to give people tools for coping with the illness over the long term, not just coping with it for an episode. This is our study, a pilot study we did here. I won't say too much about it, but again, we had compared 24 people who received MBCT to 24 who received just medication, and the MBCT group was somewhat more chronic in having had three or more episodes, and this shows the results. of the medication only people had only a mild decrease versus the decrease in depression and anxiety that the people receiving mindfulness-based cognitive therapy received. And 30% remitted with mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, whereas only 10% remitted with usual treatment. And again, this is a severe population. So there have been a number of studies actually around the world. This was in England, and this was in Australia. This is an interesting just sidelight. This was done at the Black Dog Clinic in Australia. It's named after Winston Churchill because Churchill called his depression the Black Dog. The Black Dog is back today. So a little bit about self-compassion. It's basically accepting oneself, again, without the judgmental qualities. So, okay, and it's different than self-esteem. I mean, it doesn't, even a person who may not have so much self-esteem can still be compassionate towards himself and doesn't have to be critical and judgmental. And that's a big problem in depression. You know, you can call it by various terminology, like harsh superego or critical self or whatever. But people with depression are very critical of themselves. And mindfulness really teaches them a way to be kinder towards themselves and less critical. These are some comments taken from some patients who finished the group. I'm gentler on myself. I'm less critical. I can talk back to myself more. When those thoughts come up, I can say, ah, that's that person I didn't like. Now we'll talk some about the biological aspects of this. This was an intriguing study that was done with mindfulness-based stress reduction at the University of Wisconsin by Richie Davidson and John Kabat-Zinn some years ago. And basically, it was an intervention where they took people and taught. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is very similar to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, only it doesn't focus on anxiety and depression. It focuses on stress reduction and coping with a whole variety of things, from chronic pain to heart disease or cancer or whatever the case may be. It's kind of a generic stress reduction approach. And they took people at a corporation in mid-Wisconsin and taught them mindfulness-based stress reduction and showed rather remarkably that at the end of 8 weeks, the people who had received the training compared to a weightless control had activation of this left frontal region, which is associated with positive mood states, detectable on EEG. So 8 weeks of training affected the brain. And they also showed that there was an increased antibody response. They gave them influenza vaccine and showed that the antibodies to influenza rose significantly higher in the mindfulness group, so suggesting there was some neurohumoral effects from the mindfulness training. So it was an intriguing study. It was it was sort of splashy in that it showed these dramatic effects after 8 weeks. However, it was a little bit biased in the sense of John Kabat-Zinn, who if any of you have seen, I mean, it was kind of a charismatic figure, flew in from Massachusetts each week to give the group the mindfulness-based training. So one group got John Kabat-Zinn flying in, and the other group got nothing. And they actually got a little worse, you know, because their friends were getting the good stuff. But it was an intriguing study, and it highlighted something that I think leads into probably one of the most important points to take away from tonight with. And that is, we now know there is significant abnormalities in the brain in people who are suffering depression. from other psychiatric disorders as well, but I'm going to focus on depression tonight because we now know a lot more specifically about the abnormalities that are taking place. And in brief, you can think of the brain as being regulated by different systems of control. There's a dorsal executive control system, and dorsal means the top half of the brain, and a ventral or bottom half of the brain in yellow. Affective processing. Affective is another terminology for mood or appearance of mood. So this is involved with decision-making, reason, and so on, memory function, and this is with processing of emotions. And basically, this system has a tendency to regulate what's going on down here. In a loose sense, you see how certainly isn't one way. There's a lot of back and forth between these different parts of the system. But in depression, what you tend to see is this area. For example, I'm going to focus on this because you'll see more of it in a little bit. This is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That's right in this area in the forehead. And that's associated with executive functioning, with making decisions, with reason and judgment, memory. Whereas this area is with processing emotion, and particularly the amygdala is probably the most widely known, although it's these other areas as well. But take the amygdala, for example. Like, it is very active in depression. So the person is acting, when you look at this, and you'll see it in a little bit, in depression, this has increased activation, and this is decreased activation. So just breaking it down to simplify it a bit, this is decreased, or the emotional processing down here is hyperactive, and this is hypoactive. So the person is being driven by emotions and not thinking very clearly about processes. And I don't think I think we could all relate to that. When you're upset about something, you're not thinking things through very clearly. And if we took a snapshot of your brain with an fMRI machine, we would see most likely some of these alterations in these systems. And so we developed that study looking at the fMRI, hypothesizing we would see changes in treatment-resistant depression, that there would be decreased dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, but with mindfulness training, we'd see an increase. We believe that mindfulness training energizes that area of the brain. It restores attentional control to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. There's various studies that have shown that it, just like Richie Davidson's study showed it with an EEG, on fMRI studies, mindfulness is associated with enhancement of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. And we also see in depression the increased amygdala activations, and we are hoping that we will see decreased amygdala activations along with an increase in dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So in other words, we're seeing this area re-exert control over this emotional processing. This is an example of this that was done with mindfulness-based stress reduction for 8 weeks. And the key finding here is to show that these are pre- and post-training. To show, if you can just see how this is active here, and down here it's more lateral. It's an example of how the mindfulness training shifts the brain function to be more focused on the present moment, in this case, on feeling sensations in the body, than existed before the training took place. So we're using a couple of different tasks in the fMRI machine to actually look at people's functioning while they're in the fMRI machine to see what happens in their brain. And basically, we have them look at a scrambled colored figure and then look at some objects and then some more images and then show them objects and ask them to recall which of these did you see, and they press they have a button on each hand. They can press either right or left. Which one did you see before? So you're checking how much they maintain things in their memory. And you also give them different kinds of stimuli, neutral stimuli or unpleasant stimuli, emotionally evocative stimuli, or pleasant. This is a baby and a baby seal. So you show them different things to see how much they are affected. And the idea with, as you'll see, is that depression can affect this quite a bit. So this is how much does the person maintain their working memory function. And basically, this top row are treatment-resistant patients from our study, and these are healthy controls from another study. They're not perfectly matched, but similar. And what you see is that people with treatment-resistant depression, if you subtract this from that and this from that, this shows you how much the TRD patients are really different. And you see that there's very great activation to both emotional distractors, those things, the emotionally evocative pictures, as well as neutral distractors, like the baby seal, or the scrambled picture, rather. And the amygdala is very active in these patients. So the amygdala is firing both with neutral and emotionally evocative stimuli. So it means that people with depression, these are people coming into the study with depression, have very charged ventral affective processing systems. So they're responding to stimuli, neutral or emotionally evocative, by getting very hyper activation in the amygdala, which is sort of like the, in some ways, you know, stimulates other areas of the brain to react. Here's another image that shows something quite similar. The people with depression here's the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, and here's the ventral lateral prefrontal cortex, which is an area like the amygdala, which is deeper here. But in this image, it was focused on this. It shows that these individuals have decreased, the depressed individuals have decreased activation. It's cooler, it's blue, than the people down here in the ventral affective processing system. And so these people are, again, have very charged emotion systems, and they are decreased in their memory. This relates to, incidentally, why people with depression sometimes say, I can't remember anything. I mean, it isn't just, sometimes they're mistaken for being demented. So they've called it, you know, depressive pseudo-dementia. It isn't really so pseudo in the sense of their brain function is actually decreased. It's not dementia in terms of irreversible, because if they get the depression treated appropriately, it's completely reversible. But you can see how this area that is tasked with maintaining memory and executive function is deactivated, in a sense, in this state. Well, this is another example to show that the best is that with emotional probes, you see in these individuals, when they're trying to recall memory, they have to light up much larger areas of the brain than the individual here, because they have trouble concentrating. The person who has depression, if any of you know folks like that, you say, I don't remember anything, or I can't decide anything. I don't know what to wear. I don't know what I should do. I don't know what I should do in this situation. I can't problem solve. Well, part of that is because they actually lack the ability in their executive function areas of their brain to make those decisions and to remember as they would have if their brains were returned to normal. This shows in our population of people with treatment-resistant depression, what you see here is activation of the subgenual area and the rostral ACC, anterior cingulate cortex. This area, Brodmann's area 25, is a hallmark of particularly difficult to treat depression. And have all of you heard about the deep brain stimulation for depression? I don't know if you No, this is, it isn't the vagus nerve. What the deep brain stimulation is, it's an experimental approach, and actually it involves a neurosurgical procedure where they drill a hole in the brain, in the skull, and insert an electrode into the brain, and it's attached to a pacemaker. And Helen Mayberg, who is at Emory now, developed this. And it's been done in probably about 60 people in the world so far. So, I mean, it's not a widely, it's still quite experimental. But where it's placed is right here. The electrode is placed in this region. And when she turns on the stimulator, before the stimulator, the person says, how do you feel? Terrible. The weight of the world is on me. They flip the switch. The person doesn't know that. It's blind. This is while they're in the operating room, incidentally. So they are making sure they're in the right area. They flip the switch. How do you feel now? Light. Free. Just like that. And the stimulation shuts this. It isn't to stimulate it. It's to turn it off. This area has to be turned off. And it's possible that we may start to see there are different ways of turning this area off. Stanford is doing some research, Ian Gottlieb, on using fMRI feedback to train people visually to turn this off. And we are hopeful we'll see some changes with mindfulness training on this as well. So we don't have the results of that yet, but let me save the questions for the end. But it's certainly intriguing, and it would be a lot more palatable, I think, for people than having a hole drilled in their head. I think. I don't know. But it is dramatic. She shows videotapes of the people, and these are people who have been very depressed. They've had electroconvulsive treatment, they've had 20 different medications and nothing has helped them, and they can respond instantly. This is another condition that we use. This is while the people are in the scanner, we ask them to look at these different images. One is to label affect, so label that mood state. Is this person angry or scared? And then as a control for that, we ask them, what's this person's name, Sylvia or Alan? These are matched to be the same number of letters and the same length. And this is just observe the affective face. And this is a control to just see match this with this, to do matching without any affective component to it. So this is a way to see how people process emotions, and our thought is that people with depression don't process them very well. So here's an example of that, this state, just observing. So look at this face. They're in the scanner, and then we see what happens in their brain. This is the amygdala region. Now watch what happens to that same region when we ask them to label it. So they're seeing the face and say, let's say angry. Let's say, okay, now label it. Watch this area. So the same, by the process of labeling, that's, you can see in a sense, drawing on that, the executive functioning areas of the brain dampens that amygdala response. So the person, instead of having, say, ooh, it's an unpleasant face, I'm exaggerating a little bit, and they can't move their head in the scanner anyhow, but instead of them having this reaction by saying, ah, angry face. And this is essentially what we're doing in mindfulness training. Say, so they're focusing on their breath, and they start to feel, oh, I'm really angry about this interaction with my boss, or this, or I'm really depressed about this breakup, or whatever, say, sadness. What we teach people is to frame their emotions. So say, okay, when your mind wanders, notice what it is it's wandering to. So, okay, I've got a planning thought. What am I going to do tomorrow? I've got anger, and bring the attention back. And you can start to see how some of these things are connected, because they're not just, blowing smoke. It's actually affecting and enhancing the brain's ability to function in certain respects and restoring the dorsal executive control system to re-exert some control over the emotional processing component of the brain. Here you see it for the first 22 patients that we've had. You see how in healthy individuals, you see the amygdala you see here how there's no emotional response to those shapes. There was just those black dots. There's very little reactivity. Here you see whether it's a neutral, whether any of the other conditions, just observing those faces, labeling the gender, or labeling the affect, didn't really change much. In normal people, you would see this decrease significantly. But in people who are depressed, they're lacking that capacity to process emotions. And this other area, the ventral lateral prefrontal cortex, was another part of that same ventral system that I showed you on that slide. Like the amygdala, the same effect takes place here. The ventral lateral prefrontal cortex has increased activations across all these conditions, except for just the matching shape control. I thank various people who've helped. You've already met Natalie here, but Dan Mathlon is the neuroimaging specialist who I collaborate with from the VA, and I'm sure I'm leaving other people out, but I've got a wonderful team that makes this research possible. And I wanted to just highlight a couple other things. This is the book that really got it started. It's called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy. I think it's about 2002. It's actually in revision. He's making a new edition, but it isn't out yet. But for this is focused on clinicians, really. I would say for most people, this would be the book to get. And this is like 2007 or 8. And The Mindful Way Through Depression. This is a fabulous book. It's written by all of the originators of this approach. And it has a CD at the back cover with meditations by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And so it's very clear and very easy to read and very useful. They caution in there not to use it for people who are actively depressed, which is different because these folks, Zindel Siegel and Mark Williams, have used it primarily for relapse prevention. But as you've heard, we're using it to treat depression that is active, and there's a broadening I think movement to do so around the world. So keep that in mind when you read that admonition in the book, if you do get it. But it's a beautifully written book, and I think you all enjoy it. This is the our study. There's a couple of these handouts up here if you're interested in participating or know somebody who might be, either people who have failed to recover completely and are on two antidepressants, have had two antidepressant trials, rather, or for people who aren't on any antidepressants or aren't in any kind of therapy and want to do this. Both of them are free, and actually we pay you to go through the assessments, and you get your brain scanned before and after. So it's kind of neat. They give you your brain scan in a disc, and you can use it as a screensaver. I should have brought mine. I know I love mine. They do this 3D image of your head, except they cut off your face. It's rather eerie, but kind of amazing, because it's the perfect reconstruction of your brain. And this is the website you can go to. If you go to the UCSF Department of Psychiatry and search for me, you can get it that way, but this is in there as well. And well, at this point, why don't we open up for questions? Yeah. Okay, the question is, what about obsessive-compulsive disorder and the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, or how are they related, and can mindfulness training help with that? I think it there haven't been much in the way of good studies about it, but in obsessive-compulsive disorder, it's to a large extent deeper basal ganglia structures that are hyper-functioning. So you may see the caudate and putamen and some of these other regions that are have increased activity, along with some of these other areas of the brain that may be involved, especially midline structures like the ventromedial prefrontal cortex and the orbital frontal cortex, where you see some of those also have increased activation. What tends to occur in depressive disorders is those midline structures are focused, and you see increased activation in depression and in ruminative states tend to diminish as the person gets mindfulness training. That's why I showed you that one slide where that shifted from the midline to be more laterally focused after mindfulness training. But there haven't been really good randomized controlled trials of mindfulness training that I'm aware of for obsessive compulsive disorder. You'd think it would be useful, but I don't think it's been tested yet. Yes, back there. Well, the question is that depression can affect memory, and does that have some relationship to depression and Alzheimer's? That's a good question. I don't think the answer is completely clear. Depression is a risk factor for Alzheimer's. That's definitely true. Why that is may not necessarily be related to what we were looking at here, because that Alzheimer's is a more diffuse brain disease, and this is really talking about specific areas and about reversible changes. So that if you treat people successfully for depression, you'll see that dorsolateral prefrontal cortex that had decreased activation restored to normal. It goes back to normal. And that obviously isn't the case with Alzheimer's. Now, on the other hand, whatever may predispose, say vascular changes that may predispose to depression or to Alzheimer's, may be a common link there. So there's some connection, but I don't think it's well worked out yet. Yes? Okay. The question is, the yoga has some of the same features. And meditation. Yes. Actually, I think they might make the same claims. It hasn't been as well studied, but there are studies, particularly in India, of using yoga as a treatment for major depression. And one of our colleagues here at the Osher Center has been using sky yoga as a treatment. I can't pronounce the what it stands for, but it involves breathing techniques and other elements of focusing the attention. So there is a great deal of overlap. You're quite right that there's a lot of overlap between some of the terminology and some of the features of yoga, and we use yoga in the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And some people, that's the thing they come away with the most that they want to focus on. So there is a lot of overlap. In fact, if somebody is practicing yoga twice a week or more, they're ineligible for our study because they're already doing many of the same things. Okay, well, that's a good question, a complicated one, but there's what happens to people who've been traumatized? It can be difficult to treat because it is so traumatic for them. There are efforts to apply this technique to trauma. There's a study going on at the University of Michigan of using a mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans, for example. It has to be modified significantly from the approach I told you. Like, for example, you could see if you have somebody who's been molested or raped or something like that, and you ask them to lie down in the class and do a body scan, they may jump out of their skin. It may not be an easy thing for them to do, or for even to sit still for 45 minutes of breathing or something like that. So there has to be significant modifications. But on the other hand, the mindfulness may help them gain some distance from the situation. A lot of what happens in a lot of different states, I'd say, a lot of psychiatric disorders, is that people get upset about them. And the upset about the disorder is almost worse than the disorder. So people with post-traumatic stress disorder get fearful about having a flashback. And what, as an example, and there's a technique, it's called metacognitive therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder, which actually says, okay, you're going to have flashbacks. But instead of saying, oh, that's terrible, or that's abnormal, or that's scary, you say, okay, there's the flashback. That's what happened. I'm going to have it. And accepting it, as it were, and paradoxically, that tends to diminish it. Tending to resist it has a tendency to increase the prevalence of those things. So it's a specific technique that can be quite useful in helping people accept, okay, this is what's going on. The same thing is true of depression. A lot of people get depressed about being depressed. You know, because that part of what we teach in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is, okay, here's depression. What does that feel like? Well, it doesn't feel good, or I feel tension, or, you know, whatever it is, or I got a headache with this, or a stomach ache, or whatever. But it's only going to get worse. This is going to be a disaster. And the depressive thoughts start to occur about depression. And if you can get the person to disengage and say, okay, here's the depression. Here's what it feels like. But let go of those other thoughts, like it's terrible I have depression. I'm a weakling because I have depression. It's morally bad that I have depression. I must have sinned because I have depression. All of that crap. And just have the straight depression is actually diminishes the suffering. It's like saying, okay, and we use this example in our course, okay, here's Winston Churchill's black dog came in the room. Here's the black dog. Now, you could say, I'm scared of black dogs. You know, they're terrible. It's a big black dog. This is terrible. It's here, you know. What is it going to do? What's the next thing that's going to happen? It's going to bite me or this, that. You say, okay, here's the black dog, but we teach less resistance and say, okay, let's, instead of panicking, let's just take a look at this. Observe, bring your mindful awareness to this. What does a black dog look like? It may not be a good-looking black dog, but when you stop and let go of the fear, it changes the relationship and says, well, actually, it's not that bad-looking, you know, I may be able to learn something from it. You know, like one woman said, when her depression came back, she used to be terrified. But after the course, when the depression came up, she says, you know, When the depression comes up, now I know it's a signal that I'm not asserting myself in a relationship. And so she started to actually use the depressive awareness in a much different way than being terrified. Oh, no, here comes the depression again. So that's, I think, the best answer I can give you about post-traumatic stress. Yeah, up there. Okay. Is depression contagious? There are also a lot of ways of dealing with depression, too. Let's not forget that. I hope, I don't know, the other speakers have been addressing that as well. I think certainly it's not contagious, you know, like an infectious disease exactly, but I think you raise a good point. You know, there are these things called memes of ideas that can get transmitted to from one person to another or to whole groups of people. And if I say, oh, yes, the world is a terrible place, and everybody walks out of here believing that, which I'm sure is not going to happen. But if that was the case, yes, you could have a contagion of ideas. I think more resilient people are able to usually differentiate whether, well, this person is saying that because of, you know, their depressive state or whatever. So it normally is not contagious in that sense. But it's not pleasant to be around somebody who's depressed. And if you're in that situation, it could be a stressor in itself. Yes, it could be. But it's not exactly contagious per se. And hopefully you'd be able to have the enough distance from, you know, if I said, you know, I don't even know why you're coming here because there's nothing to be done about any of this. You know, this is all garbage. You know, you would say, well, this guy's a lousy lecturer or something. You know, you wouldn't accept that. And you'd have enough observation powers to distance yourself. So normally it does not directly lead to depression. But having a depressed loved one has the potential for being a significant stressor. Anybody hasn't? Yeah. The question is, what would qualify, what professional training would qualify a person to do MBCT training? I think being in the mental health field of some type, and there's, you know, a variety of different licensures that one can have, so they're very familiar with depression and the variations of it. And then I think the other requirement is having your own personal mindfulness practice, because you can't read the book and say, okay, I'm going to go do this, and not have a mindfulness practice. It doesn't work. Because, like, in order to be able to say, well, I can see these thoughts emerging, you have to have seen your own thoughts emerging into consciousness. So you have to have a mindfulness practice. So, you know, rather than being like, I'm going to go teach swimming because I've read about it, and you do one like this and one like this, and it's easy as pie. You know, unless you've swam, you're not going to be able to teach it. So that's probably the most important thing. Then I think you could be a variety of disciplines.
Part of the reason I was asking you.
Well, the question is, how does this relate to Buddhism? Some Buddhist practitioners, I think a lot of them who get into the mental health arena have degrees or licensures in psychology or counseling or something along that line. I think the difference, I would say, to teaching this, the structure and the terminology are rooted in psychological concepts, built upon mindfulness meditation, which is, of course, related to Buddhist meditation in its early roots. So there is overlap, but it's rather secular, and people have issues sometimes about that. You know, can you teach a meditation in a secular way and so on? But our experience is, yes, you can, and we don't use... if you go to a Buddhist retreat, you get a completely different slant on these things than what we're teaching. Okay, one more question. Oh, the question is, why couldn't this be taught in schools to prevent depression? That's a great point, and there's a movement to do exactly that. There's a growing tendency to have mindfulness meditation in schools, and Stanford has a project teaching elementary school kids that, and of trying to have it be part of the educational system. There was a study that was done here of teaching teachers how to be more mindful, called the Cultivating Emotional Balance Study, that was partially funded by the Dalai Lama, actually, and showed that you can, by helping teachers become more mindful, you passed it along to the next generation. So I think there's a lot of effort occurring in trying to move it into preventive techniques. In fact, some of us were talking about trying to do it to giving mindfulness-based prevention to high school seniors going off to college as a way of preventing this. But it's moving there, but there's a lot of work to show that it's effective and prove it, and the challenges in developing an effort like that. But it's definitely moving in that direction. So thanks for that question. All right, thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.